Good morning.
Good morning, Jaya. Here we are.
Here we are. Good morning, Tamer. We've been crossing paths. Out on the East Coast, up the
Yes.
coast lately.
Yes, all the time going in and out, really staying in the stream, but in different locations. And I am so grateful that you came all the way from the UK to be with us in Washington, D.C. for the convention. And then so good to hear you again in Santa Barbara. So
Oh,
this is a gift.
yeah, it is. Thank you for that. Each time it's a joy, to see you, DC. Oh man, what can we say? That's a whole conversation right there. Just, oh my goodness, you did it up. That was
I'm so grateful for you and people like Dr. Jennifer who helped to shift the tide, who have a heart and eyes for healing the healers. And I just know it's a special gifting to see minister to pour into people who are usually pouring. And I have seen and heard you do that with social workers, with teachers, with foster parents. And it is an intentional work, and it also reveals your great insight to be able to see those who often are unseen because of their strength.
Thank you for that. Thank you for seeing, for seeing the truth, really, in the calling. I appreciate you doing that because, these callings are not as commonly recognized as some other callings in the world. What you do, and the journey I've been on, and so. It's nourishing just to be recognized and seen for what is actually happening, right? When you are with a group of souls, of people, it's not just that surface aspect of, you've come in and you're sharing a message. Like that's the really almost the least of what's happening. You're transmitting your own soul, your ancestral soul, your generational soul, the collective soul. You're transmitting all of that, and you're opening yourself wide and dilating and receiving all of that back from all the other souls. And so it's so much more than just an event or a conference or a symposium or a lecture or a book signing or what have you, right? It's so much more than that. And that's why I'm grateful just to have this sacred conversation with you, because we find ourselves in a very painful moment amongst all of the blessings and the glory of life. There's also so much pain, of course, that's always flowing, and at this particular time, it's very concentrated and intense. And so I just want to thank you for joining me for this conversation this morning for us. And I know we pray that this can be medicine for the souls who need it out and beyond. And I'm really, really thankful this morning. Thank you so much for
Yes.
being a part of this.
I am holding the fullness of what you're sharing, both the great pain and grief that we are carrying and seeing and feeling globally and locally, and then also being aware of our gratitude and expectation for healing and for restoration, and that one doesn't cancel out the other. Because sometimes there's the idea that if I acknowledge the pain, it will overwhelm me and consume me, and I won't be able to come up from that. So I can't acknowledge it. Or on the other side, that kind of toxic positivity of I just must be grateful, 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 and never sit with the pain. And so that invitation for us to be aware and present for the full range of all of our feelings, which reminds me of a line you said in your keynote, which was simply, we are human, are we not? Right?
Yeah.
Are we not, right?
Yeah.
Like that rehumanizing of like, I am not a machine, I'm a human being, right? I am not just my labor, I'm a human being, right? I am not just a doer or a giver, right? So to lean into that, and whenever we lean into that, whatever shows up is a gift, right? Mm-hmm. Yeah, because it's truth. So when I can tell myself and others the truth, it's a beautiful, necessary, sacred gift. So I have been looking forward to this conversation as well, where truth can abide.
Wow, thank you. I'm emotional listening to your expression when you say, you know what a gift it is to be able to tell others the truth. And what made me emotional about you saying that is just a divine revelation in the moment that to tell others the truth actually comes in many, many forms. You know, we associate telling with verbal expression, but what I just heard you say really is that by embodying all that we are, emotionally, spiritually, physically, psychologically, mentally, behaviorally, socially, by embodying all of what we are truth telling in all those aspects. So the story gets communicated in all of those ways. And, you know, even our posture, the way we carry ourselves, the facial expressions that we grant to others. The longer I live, the more aware I am of the power that we hold in the way we influence and make each other feel just by these micro expressions and very nuanced aspects of our being, which is why I love your relationship with dance and the body, because, you know, for example, at the APA convention in DC and then up the coast in at Pacifica the other day, in both cases, you wonderfully served as a symphony conductor of sorts to help the people align themselves with their truths, whatever it was they might be feeling in those particular moments, because you did encourage and invite them into dance, into motion. And that's, to me, a wonderful ministry, to invite people into alignment with whatever they may be feeling or moving through. And there's an honesty in dance, an honesty in movement, once we really surrender to it. And so, right now, I feel us collectively as human beings having a very deep need to attend to our bodies and what we are carrying in them, because they are the holding place for all of our emotions and feelings and trauma and fear and uncertainty and anxiousness and dreams and hopes and prayers. They gather in our bodies, and you know that if we're not mindful of how those energies are gathering, they can, the energies themselves become a form of suffering, which then in fact can lead to not only disease, but social conflict and violence. And so this is my way of saying that I have been beholding the way that you serve in the world. And I guess I want to ask you, this question has really come to my heart as I was listening to you. Here we are in October, and you have been on this amazing grace of a journey as president of the American Psychological Association. And you've been on this journey as a woman. Going back to when I was 18 and Nikki Giovanni was blessing the microphone with poetry, and it mm-hmm. was the night I was broken and was born into poetry and writing. And she, that night, through her poetry and her soul, she...
I'm sorry, Jaya. I just have to highlight what you just said. The night I was broken is the night I was born. Wait a minute.
Okay. Yeah, you can always interrupt me because it's true. It's true. As I the more I share that story, the more I realize because people are always curious, right? How did you become, say, the artist you are, right? They're curious about that. And I'm sure that people ask you about that a lot. But she broke me. I was broken completely. And by broken, I mean that all of the mechanisms that I had adapted as ways to survive childhood.
Yeah.
Right? Mm-hmm. And I know you speak on this a lot. You write on this a lot. All of the ways that I came into to bear the pain, the profound pain that I experienced in childhood, and it was not a childhood of pain, but I'm saying as for all of us, there was pain. And the ways that I had come into to not with much awareness or enlightenment, but it was just me as a child, you know, trying to find a way to protect my heart, to protect my soul, and to protect my actual physical body from the violence and hate that I sensed around me and experienced around me, and also the injury that comes from not being seen, not being related to, not being understood, not being validated or affirmed, all of these injuries we experience as children. I had come into that night at age 18. I'm thinking, and I don't even know, Tama, when I think about it, what even caused me to leave my dorm room that night and walk across campus and go to these council chambers for this woman who I was not that familiar with her. Right. But spirit was just got me up out of that dorm room. Right.
You needed to be.
And I was there. And so what she broke was all of my defenses, all of the walls, all of the dams holding back the river flow. She broke down these identities that I had harvested. She broke down fear, actually, which is something that we'll be talking about next week in a sacred word gathering. And I believe you and I will probably end up talking about fear as well in LA on the 20th. But and I say she, but obviously it was spirit acting through Nikki Giovanni, because in that auditorium, although she's a small woman, she was gigantic. Her spirit filled the entire space. And all of these hundreds of souls were overcome by that grace. And I drank and drank and drank, and I beheld a soul saying, "I am a woman and you can do nothing about that."
Yes.
She was speaking to her oppressors, and she was speaking to her beloved humanity at the same time, her beloved daughters and sisters, right? And mothers and aunties in particular. She was speaking affirmation, but she was also speaking resistance by saying, "I am a woman and you can't do a thing about that." In other words, I am divinely appointed and anointed to be a woman in this lifetime, and all of your issues with that cannot make a mark, cannot shift. Yeah. And then taste, she said,
pollute, make me apologize for, make me shrink. Yeah. None of that. Yeah.
None of that. You cannot bend me over. Mm-hmm. You can't. And she said, and this was all poetically, she was saying, you know, I'm a Black woman and you cannot divide that.
Yes.
And she said, I'm a Black woman and a human being. And, you know, you can't resist that. Mm-hmm. You can do nothing about it. And so it did devastate all of the self-imprisoning defense mechanisms that I had adapted. And so because it decimated all of that, and it was painful, and I was shedding oceans of tears as I walked back to the dorm room, but because all of that structure that I had built up had just been blown away, it did birth me the same night. I was broken and born.
Wow. So beautiful.
Thank you. And and so I, you know, this lives with me. This truth has been a part of my life, and it brings me to this curiosity about you, which is, you know, you haven't just been during this term the president of the American Psychological Association. You've been president as a Black woman, and all that means for you, but all that it means for those who you have been leading and serving and collaborating working with, weaving the tapestry of healing with all of these different souls, their own ideas and feelings and history and relationship with what it means to be Black, what it means to be a woman, what it means to have a Black woman leading you. And so that, along with you being in the actual ministry and being in the actual clinical therapeutic practice and being an actual professor and being an actual author and being a mentor and a guide and a mother and a daughter, this year, this last year has been so full and fertile for you. And I would just love to hear, I would be honored to hear what this has been like for you. That's simply the question.
Mm-hmm. Thank you. Thank you so much. And thank you for sharing your testimony. I know it will minister both to those who are in a broken place, whether they signed up for it or not. Often we do not sign up for our breaking seasons, but that not only something can be born out of that, but that we can be born out of that. And I can reflect on seasons in my own life where, you know, the world is shaking, the internal and sometimes external world is shaking, and being able to have that mustard seed faith that there has to be more for me than this. And that's what allows for the getting up. That's what allows for the renaming and redefining and being reborn. And so I just want to highlight that for those who are in the broken place and are listening right now, to allow for the birthing, the stretching, that old things are passed away. Behold, something new is coming. Behold, something new is coming. And I'll go back to your question first about embodiment. And dance has really been a saving grace for me. As I've shared with you and others before, I'm a sexual assault survivor and was assaulted during my college years. And as opposed to many people who end up hating their bodies or feeling like the truth is buried in their bodies, because I was already a dancer, I had a relationship with me physically that superseded the relationship of the offender or the action of the offender, right? And I also even when I wasn't talking about it, I was dancing it. So I didn't feel bound. Like I had already said it many, many times in movement. And some people, very rare people who are observant, could pick that up. I remember as a student at Duke, maybe a year after it happened, there was a student dance concert. And I did this dance and, you know, people kind of applauded, said, oh, wow, that was powerful. And there was one brother who later became a nurse, and which is significant in terms of being observed. Yes. He came to me after the performance and was the only one to say, I'm so sorry that happened to you.
Wow.
And I was shook. Like, how did he see that? Because other people was like, were just like, oh, that was a little moving choreography. So I say that to say, if you don't yet have the words, dance it, sing it, collage it, paint it, that in our art, in our poems, we heal. It gives us room to speak the unspeakable. And that's liberating, even if you're not around people who have ears to hear it or eyes to see it or the words to respond in the way you are looking for a response.
Wow.
Yes. Yeah. No, he really startled me. I'm like, wait, what?
In other words,
like I have been seen, right?
Yeah.
Somebody saw what I thought was coded. Yeah.
Wow.
And so, so I love dancing, and we have bodily memories, right? If you curl up in a ball, you think about the times when you have been curled up in a ball before, right? When you're stretching or walking in tall with your head up and your shoulders back, like what does that remind you of? What were the moments where you felt secure, you know? So we can both express what we feel in our bodies and also shift our internal atmosphere by shifting our bodies. And I have loved to give others that gift of teaching dance to people from children all the way to seniors. And I remember in South Los Angeles, I had an adult dance group, and a very senior woman showed up with a box of brand new ballet slippers. And she said, I always wanted to be a ballerina. And I said, all right, put your shoes on, let's go. Right. So that invitation to come back to our bodies, because as both of us have experienced various forms of trauma, we know it can result in us being very rigid, very stiff, you know, very contained, very controlled is what it is, right? Yeah. Having to control it all. And so to be able to breathe and release and experience ease is a part of the healing. So, wow. Yeah.
Thank you for such really a revelatory invitation back into our bodies, because, you know, I've been, you know, I feel everything in the world. And I feel it deeply, and I feel us collectively going through a moment where there's a lot of disembodiment. We are feeling pain in the heart, and then there's all this social turbulence going back and forth in the head, but the rest of our body, our physical being, it's, you know, as though, and this is what trauma does, it can dissociate us and cause us to go into a flight away from the self. But you are, in a very beautiful way, inviting us right now just to return home, and to do so in the creative ways that are natural for us. You know, so thank you for that.
And then I have to, you know, echo our words of, I often use homecoming, and you use mindfulness, right?
Yeah.
But that desire for the grounding and the centering and being present with ourselves, with compassion and grace. And that connects to your second question about being in this role as president and being very much at home in my identity as a Black woman and as a Black woman of faith. And it is so necessary for us to get to the place of clarity where we are not hungry for other people's definition of us or other people's acceptance of us. And I tell the students that I teach at Pepperdine University, if you get to the point of graduation and you have left yourself behind, we have robbed you. Go back and get yourself, right? Go back and get yourself. So it's like whatever our picture is of what it either means to be a professional or to be an adult or to be acceptable or to be smart, like whatever the picture that other people have given you of what that must look like, when that is counter to your very identity, that is violence because it is a demand that in order to thrive, to flourish, to be successful, you cannot be you. And that's a lie. It's such a vicious lie. And it then requires that we shrink and apologize for and erase who we are. So I'm really grateful to have a community and family that poured in affirmation of my identity. That's not, I'm not walking around with a question mark of, am I enough? Right. Mm. And that took a journey, right? I was not always in that place.
Yeah.
But you know, when you are walking with the question mark, there will be people lined up to tell you you're not.
Yes. Right?
Whether yes. that is like professionally, personally, out of their own brokenness, woundedness, limitation, and their belief in all the isms, right?
Yeah.
You know, mm-hmm. they may genuinely believe someone in your body could not be smart enough, right? That someone in your body could not be worthy of this position. And it has been such a gift. I think I had shared with you that this year really feels like I'm being carried. And what I mean by that is some may understand it as being in flow.
Yes. Right?
When you are in the position that aligns with the truth of you, and you are doing the things that align with the truth of you for the causes that align with your value, there is a wind that comes with that. There is a sense of being carried, of being in the fullness of yourself. So many of us have recognized when we felt out of place, but what a gift when you are in the flow and recognize it and just continue to flow with that. So I'll just give this by way of example. You mentioned I'm also in ministry. One of the first times, or actually the first time that I formally ministered within a church, I was initially kind of doing this formula that I had heard from other ministers where, you know, you give a scripture and you have 3 points and like, that's how it goes. And I remember my brother, who's also in ministry, came to me afterwards and said, that was amazing. And you are right. The affirmation first. And you're a poet and a psychologist. So I should always hear that.
Oh, bless your brother.
Right. Wasn't that? It was like, oh, like release the formula, release your what you have seen, because what you're here to be, you haven't seen because it's you. And so then when I said, oh, like it can be poetry and healing and something I haven't seen, Like there, that's the sweet spot. And so in order to be that, I have to be at home being myself. And also the gift of artists is being okay with rejection. Because when you do it differently, people are going to say, like, what's that? Right? Yeah. What was that? I don't know what that was. And it's like, yeah, you don't know how to label it or box it because I'm not in the box. And that's okay. Yeah.
And that's all right.
Yeah.
Wow. Thank you for that. That was very nourishing for me, I know. Just to listen to you describe what has really been a gardening of your own soul to ensure that you have made a place for all that you are, mm-hmm. and it has deep roots, which allows it to flower in this flowering season and rest in the rest season, but to just be true to yourself, whatever the context you find yourself in. Mm-hmm. I love the way you describe the challenge that humans often have, which we can call, you and I can call cognitive dissonance, where mm-hmm. because they are so conditioned socially mm-hmm. with schemas about categories of people, when they see someone in a certain body, they experience mm-hmm. a lot of inner conflict. Like, this person, you could not possibly be intelligent mm-hmm. enough. You could not possibly be worthy enough. You could not possibly be educated enough, prepared enough, skilled enough. And so when they encounter your body and you are in servitude in the ways that have been appointed, and they have all these contradictions going on within them, they're experiencing a storm on the interior. And you stay in your calm and peace and serenity, knowing who you are. But it's because of, as you say, it's the gardening work, though, that you've been doing all along, and that you've been allowing others to do with you in
yes.
relationship. Yeah,
absolutely. And I want to ask you about, as we talk about the stories people create, right, based on bodies, go to something we've had some conversation about, but I would love for you to share more of what your journey has been in terms of people's response to you physically, the story they create, and how you have navigated that to hold on to your story or create your story.
Oh, thank you for asking that. And you're going to have me crying again, because I don't know if I've been asked this publicly, so I don't know if I've talked about it publicly. I certainly share with those close to me. It began as a child, of course, you know, and I have a memory of walking into my preschool classroom, which means I must have been, I was likely 3 or 4.
Mm-hmm.
And I was holding the hand of the teacher or the aide. I remember that. I remember the carpet on the floor, the windows. I can almost smell the room. This is one of my earliest memories. And this was in, you know, I was born and raised in La Tierra del Encanto, Land of Enchantment, in New Mexico. And so there was no one that looked like me around. And I remember walking into that classroom and the visceral energy shift as the other children who were already seated, maybe I was late showing up. So it didn't probably help that I was on CP timetable, but they were sitting in a circle, and then, you know, they all turned and looked and saw me walking in, and the energy shift.
And at 3 or 4,
you felt it. Yeah. I think that people who don't go on these kind of journeys, who are represented
mm-hmm.
as being the norm in society, they don't want to believe this, but it's true. Mm-hmm. Children at a very young age, we are very clear as to why people are relating to us the way mm-hmm. they are, where it's not our imagination.
Yes.
You know, people love to, what's the popular term now? They love to gaslight you about this. And, mm-hmm. They must have been looking at you because you have such a nice smile.
Right. They
must
have, oh,
you know, yes. They can't sit with it at all. They cannot sit mm-hmm. with their actual own truth.
Yes.
Because it is a reflection of them.
Yes. Let me just say, because it reminds me in this moment, I had a colleague on the East Coast and she took her son to preschool. And when she mm-hmm. picked up, he said, I was the only Black one there. And her response was, who told you that? And I'm like, what do you mean? He looked around the room, right? Wasn't some like somebody showed up and told him yeah. he looked. Yeah. So
who betrayed the secret? She was right. Like, you know, and that's how it's treated. Mm-hmm. Like mm-hmm. It's an unmentionable. If you're yes. around yes. folks that are in the norm, they mm-hmm. it's an unmentionable. You are actually not allowed to speak of your own experience. And so
mm-hmm.
One of the things that I've said metaphorically about my experience with the physical body is that, you know, as a Black boy, many people may relate to your body as a teddy bear because when you're young enough,
mm-hmm.
you know, you're not a threat in most ways. And you might be related to as, you know, cute and cuddly and adorable, and you're the teddy bear. But the moment that Tama, the moment that pre-puberty begins to kick in and you grow taller. Now yeah. I'm speaking about Black boys and something that we as Black boys, we don't ever hardly get a chance to express this in the broader humanity or have broader humanity be sensitive to it at all.
Yeah.
But this is Black boys. Okay, this is us.
Mm-hmm.
And you grow taller mm-hmm. and you sense it as you go from grade to grade or year to year as you grow taller and as your muscularity develops. Now mm-hmm. I'm talking about 6, 7, 8-year-old boys. Okay. I'm not talking about 16-year-old boys. So mm-hmm. these are still children, very, very vulnerable and in need of just in need of really being treated with a gentleness.
Yes.
Being a child, okay. But your muscularity is developing, your shoulders may broaden, mm-hmm. your voice may begin to change. Mm-hmm. And so now you start to sense, and this is not, again, imagination. Mm-hmm. It is not paranoia.
Mm-hmm.
It is valid. It is real.
Yeah.
As a grizzly bear.
Oh.
And so what does that do to the soul of a child? Because these are still children.
Mm-hmm.
When you realize that your friends, your peers, in some cases for some children, your own family, or certainly extended family, mm-hmm. your own teachers, administrators, coaches, priests, ministers, people on the street, adult authorities, when you begin to realize that your community, your county, your state, your mm-hmm. nation, your humanity sees you in your Black body as a grizzly bear, as a threat, as a violence, as a potential, a source of potential harm, mm-hmm. as an animal.
Wow.
And you're still a child?
Mm.
The pain of that.
Yes.
Yeah, the crushing pain of that and the dislocation of that. because you're trying to interpret this. You know the energy that's coming to you from others, and you're trying to interpret what does it all mean, and you're still a child, right? Yeah. So you have this tendency to want to internalize it as, oh, something must be wrong with me. And so the very same attention, the stares, the gazing, the physical discomfort, the way that their bodies are reacting to your body, the way their facial expression is reacting to your body, their tone of voice, to be walking down the street and have a parent move their child away from you, child on the other side, farther from you. Mm-hmm. Then there's the invisibility, you know, Ralph Ellison. There's the invisibility that comes, you know, where, you know, and this happens in a million different ways we don't even have time for, but where you're just simply treated as though you're not there and you don't exist. So you're mm-hmm. a child, and you're surmising that, well, if they're treating me this way and relating to me this way, there's a fear element. They're afraid of me. They're mm-hmm. discomforted by me. This means that something is wrong with me. There's something that I need to identify as being wrong and inferior, and I need to do something about that. I need to hide it.
Mm-hmm.
I need to divorce myself from it. I need to shun it. In some cases, a child will go the other direction and be very, very prideful about it, but mm-hmm. not in a way that is actually healing or mm-hmm. helping. It's more of like a defiant, resentful kind of pride that becomes an exaggeration identity.
Yes. Right?
And yes. So either way, that child, that boy, is still not living in peace with his whole self. And mm-hmm. so I went through childhood and then adolescence, you know, managing all that. And the way that I did was not, you know, it was not helpful at all. It was very self-harming, self-destructive, mm-hmm. self-rejecting. Mm-hmm. And that's part of why I became mute and silent. And mm-hmm. for me, Tama, you know, people would say, oh, they're just, you know, that attention is because you're so handsome, or you're so tall, or you're so this or that. You know, they're doing all of that. They're still running away from the truth.
Yeah, that did fail.
Yeah, and I'm living it daily. Now, I'm not only daily, but all day, every day.
Yes.
Everywhere I'm going, okay? And so now you're also dealing with the gaslighting. So because that's also very harmful. People who are supposed to love you, mm-hmm. you know, are denying your reality.
Yes.
Constantly. Okay. And then there's the stereotyping.
Mm-hmm.
And this goes to things I know I've shared with you. Mm-hmm. This takes us all the way to this, to today. Every single day of my life,
mm-hmm.
I experience usually an older white person,
mm-hmm.
But I experience another human being in places where I should be able to be at peace with myself, in the grocery store shopping, mm-hmm. On the street walking,
right,
out in a park meditating, mm-hmm. where I should be able to just be at peace, right?
Yes.
There is this violent intrusion, some call microaggression, but I call, you know, how can an aggression be micro?
Yes.
Because if it is aggression, then it is as big as the sky.
That's right.
And they're saying, oh, you must be an athlete. You must be an athlete. Who do you play for? Now, first of all, I'm 893 years of age, right? So what are you even talking about?
You don't even see me, right?
You do not see me clearly, mm-hmm. right? But then it's just, you know, when they don't get the response that they are expecting, that they feel entitled to, now they're offended. Oh, right. You should let me take a compliment, you know.
Mm-hmm.
Because one time I just simply said, you know, the guy said, I'm trying to eat. Now I'm in the middle of eating.
Mm-hmm.
And he comes with his, oh, yeah, you must be an athlete, which for us feels very reductive, dehumanizing mm-hmm. and hurtful.
Yes.
So I replied, you know, I'm a human being.
Mm-hmm.
And he was so offended by that.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
You know, so in the spaces that I've occupied in servitude as a professor, as a speaker, as an author, as a psychologist, as a mentor, consultant, what have you, all these different spaces, the same kind of dynamic occurs. The same stories unfold where people are, they're reacting to my physical body and it's a combination. You know, I'm not naive. I understand that. It's some of it is size, some of it is shape, some of it is skin, some of it is voice, you know, some of it is whatever energy. People are having experiences with my energy. So I'm not saying that I experience all of these interactions as a negative thing. There's a lot of people that are just overwhelmed in a positive way.
Mm-hmm.
I think by the energy of love, which I have worked very hard to be a vessel for and a conduit for.
Yeah.
And so I appreciate.
Mm-hmm. And that feels different, right?
It feels very different.
Actually seeing you and appreciating you. So a part of what I'm feeling is not only the pain of the actual experience and that it's not a rare experience, right? But that the commonality of it from childhood through to the present.
Yeah.
But what I'm also hearing and what you have said is the additional pain of the denial, the fact that, you know, you early on had to say in the story, this is not paranoia. Like, to me, that is even painful, that knowing that that is how some people think or will interpret or question your very experience, as if they could be an expert on your life.
That's it.
So
And so it's like, you know, going back to something you expressed, for me, it's been a continuous opportunity to reconcile what I'm here in the world for with how my human nature experiences what is often a very toxic and harmful way of being related to by others. So so this reconciling continuously of, okay, I'm here to be love and to love. I'm here to be medicine and offer medicine. I'm here for compassion and mercy and grace.
Mm-hmm.
And as I move through the moments of the day, there's this like an asteroid shower of harm raining on me because of people's own sickness related to race, in particular, maybe gender to some degree, but nonetheless, it's this constant, you know, showering. And so what do I do with that?
Mm-hmm.
For example, in the Instagram space, in the social media space, if I choose to express something from a place of love with an intention of offering medicine, and others, because of their condition, experience those words according to their own projections, and then they have a reaction that it itself is toxic, violent, harmful. And especially if they feel they're entitled to spew that at me because of my race, or because of the nature of social media, they just feel entitled. Then there is my opportunity again. Each of these moments is my opportunity to turn to myself and my creator and say, okay, here are the choices. What do I choose? Do I choose to be shamed and silenced? Do I back off and back up? Do I withdraw from the struggle for freedom from oppression? Do I withdraw from the human need for medicine, for healing? Or do I open myself wider? Do I become more of what I am? You know, for you example, like, do I dance? If people are violently oppressing my dance, do I choose to stop dancing or do I keep dancing? Do I dance even more?
Yes. I love widen and be more of yourself.
Yes.
Instead of shutting down, right? I have a choice. Do I close off and shut down or do I widen that boldness, to not be erased and to not consent or come into agreement with those whose intention is to erase you and to silence you.
Amen.
Mm-hmm.
So in other words, in this moment, who do I choose as my authority? That person who's trying to silence and erase me, is that my God? Who is my God?
Oh, that's good.
Because we can only worship, you know, in my perspective, you can only worship one God at a time. Like, for example, in this country, it calls itself a religious country. Mm-hmm. But in my observation, the worshiping consistently and overwhelmingly is of money, is of materialism. And so there's a contradiction spiritually there that we all, you know, struggle with and reckon with in a society like this. In a moment where someone is being harmful to you, are they your God?
And that declaration of they do not have the final say, right? They wrote a comment on social media, they could unfollow, whatever, but who do I give them? Because if I shut down, they had the final say.
Yes.
And so I won't be able to recall it, but I had an old poem called Somebody Tried to Hold My Pen Hostage. And, right, it's about that reclaiming of the pen. And sometimes that's strangers in social media, sometimes that's your own family, sometimes that's partners. But you know, no matter who shows up to take the pen, like, it's yours.
It's yours.
Right? Yours. So I want to so appreciate you, not just for, because this conversation, I feel, is a reflection of our larger conversation. And that is the sanctuary or emotional intimacy that is honest, as we started with. What I think about is, We often have similar language, which is, you know, what connected us. But when we can go from talking about glory and the word and healing medicine, but also have room to say, I'm frustrated, I'm tired, I'm mad. And that's the gift. And so when you started this series of sacred conversations, I knew it would model what you embody, and I think give people an opportunity to see and experience the full breadth of being so tuned in to hopefulness and also very intimate and honest about the suffering.
Oh, yeah, that's a powerful word. Thank you. Thank you for that. You know, without the emotional honesty, we do ourselves great harm and we do each other great harm because we look to each other as examples. We're just continuously doing that as human beings. We're so impressionable. And if we look around us and everybody's being emotionally dishonest, we feel that that's how we're supposed to be as well.
Right.
And you know, I understand the harm of emotional dishonesty because I practiced it for so long when I was young. Right?
Yeah. Yes.
And so I'm not honest emotionally because it's a theoretical choice. Mm-hmm. I'm honest emotionally because I've already been burned in the fire of that dishonesty. And I don't want to be burned again. I don't want to do that to myself.
Mm-hmm.
I want to encourage the people in my life, you know, my daughter and others. I want to be an example of, you know, people pleasing will kill you and take you from this world. Mm-hmm. But if you can be emotionally honest, spiritually honest, you can keep yourself in a thriving, beautiful life, and you can encourage the same in others. And so that honesty is, I think, a part of also being an artist, by the way.
Yeah.
You know, am I here to please people with my art, or am I here to be so in love with this life that my art can be nothing more than pure testimony to the truth?
That's right. And speaking of our artistry, I have to give a plug and a shout out for Dear Artist, the love letter. And it is absolutely incredible. And so for everyone, whether you are in touch with your creativity or you think you don't have the creativity, this book is such a gift. And I know they can connect with that on your platforms, on your website, and wherever books are sold. And I wonder if we can offer a combined closing benediction, a blessing.
Maybe
some may we's.
Yes. May we please. I would love that.
May we have the safety and courage to speak our truth and encounter those who will hear it and honor it.
Aho. Amen. Amen.
And Ashe.
Ashe. Thank you so much for this. I pray we are able to do this again sometime.
I'm waiting for your may we.
Oh, may we. You're waiting for may we.
Yeah.
May we. May we be so courageous and purposeful in loving this life and all that it is, that we overcome the fear that binds us from being beautiful and living our days as the gift that they are.
Amen.
I say,
and so it is. And so it is.
Arambe.
Come on. Oh, thank you, Jaya.
Thank you, Tame. I really appreciate this. Bless you as you journey. And I'll be seeing you soon. I'll see you soon.
Excellent. Bless you. Bye-bye.
Thank you. Bye.